Terence Stein. I'm working at the LLH, the Norwegian Organization for for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Rights in Oslo. I'm a trans man, transgender, transsexual, everything goes, kind of. 31 years old. Moved to Oslo half a year ago and started here. I'm working with a project called Kjønnsmangfold. It means gender variation. Or diversity is maybe a more correct translation. And we're working we're trying not to have identity focus, but be more based on the needs of the often transgender population, but all gender variation is involved. We have a network of Norwegian transgender or gender variant or supportive people throughout the country. We're trying to, and this project is all new, so we're just getting started.
It seems to be an important difference, this, the focus on identity versus a more inclusive approach. Can you speak about perhaps the background of these issues in Norway and how your involvement in this organization is born out of those needs?
Yeah. To take the history first, in 1999, I think, the possibility to have gender reassignment treatment was shut down in Norway. Then there were, before that, there were transvestite organizations, or one, Freedom of Personality Expression Norway. That's what they were called then. But then in 1999, some people started to, or maybe, I think that's the year when the Organization for the Transsexuals in Norway were established, to get possibility of treatment for that group. During the past 10 years, they've developed in a conservative way, and now clearly expresses that they are only an organization for people who get the transsexualism diagnosis. That's the only one that gets treated in Norway. You can't get treatment for any of the other gender identity disorders diagnosis. There's been a gap between the transvestites, mostly male, female, and the transsexuals, because there's a lot of people falling in between those. You have what I would call the transsexuals who don't get the right diagnosis, and therefore the transsexual organization won't help them. And you have all the other transgender people, all the variation. So I took the initiative to, well, the LLH had decided to include trans people, but they hadn't actually done anything other than changing the name, changing all the documents to, so I suggested this project to fill the gap between the organization for the transsexuals and the organization for the transvestites. And it's so far it's worked really well.
And what does the project do?
We have this trans network that I spoke about. We have an trans political board. Would that be a right translation? For the more political thing, issues. My own main focus right now is access to treatment for those who need that at the gender clinic at the Rikshospitalet, because, well, you have to get the diagnosis of transsexualism to get any treatment. If any doctor tries to help you with that, with another diagnosis, the doctor can lose his license. And we also think that there's a lot of people, the transgender population aren't that big, but...
How big is it?
Judging from international service, I would say transgender people may have 1% out of the population. And then you have transvestites who don't usually have a need for any surgery or treatment at all. And you have the transsexuals who want everything, including castration. In Norway, you have to be castrated to have your legal gender changed. We also work with anti-discrimination. There's coming a new law soon, or a couple of years. So we're working to get that as transgender friendly as we can. Also, there's some individual coaching, maybe I can say that. And the network is working, it's a social space, because a lot of our members haven't met any transgender people before. And lacks a space, for those kind of experiences, to share experiences, to share advice.
Could you speak about that, the experience of transgender or transsexual, that whole wide range of subjects that you're talking about? In Norway, historically, what has been the experience of being trans in Norway up to now?
Well, I'll start at least with the transsexuals, because it's easier to find documentation for how for transsexuals' experiences.
Before you do that, could you kindly explain to me what it is to be a transsexual as opposed to a transgender person as opposed to whatever else you want to?
Actually, I prefer if one needs categories, then I like to categorize people from transgender people in need of treatment and transgender people who don't have a need for treatment.
Okay. And what does that mean? Treatment means?
It means one or more of hormone treatment,
okay,
surgery, maybe, yeah, for the male to female, also hair removal, and anything else. And castration. At the Rikshospitalet, the gender clinic there, you have to say that you want to be castrated to get any treatment. So if you just want hormone treatment, then you have no options, actually. You could lie and say that you wanted the whole package. But I might not believe it.
Why? Because keeping the genitals means?
That means you're not real in their view.
Is that, why is that attitude so? Is it a political
I think
strategy?
It's, I think it's political. I think they're actually deciding what makes a man and what makes a woman. But they don't see it as political. And since it's a medical issue, we have a hard time getting the politicians to recognize it as a political issue. It wasn't possible to get treatment in Norway before 1960. I think the first operation was done in 67. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but around that time. And you had to be heterosexuals. That meant you had, if you're a trans man, you would have to be attracted to women, and vice versa. And you couldn't have any kids. And helped if you had a really bad childhood. And even though they removed those criteria, some of them were always informal. But it's still there, I think, because some of our members tell stories about how they're rejected partly because they're gay, partly because they have kids, and also that's a kind of quite new thing that you can't access treatment if you're over 30, I think. But there's no written. There's no documentation for that. It's we have just our members experiences to rely on, and that the age thing differs from other countries, where I've heard from some countries that the long history of trouble you have, the easier it gets. In Norway, it's not like that. And also it's there's the organization for the transsexuals in Norway has they don't want to call themselves transsexuals. They are people who get the diagnosis transsexualism, ordinary men or women, can be both according to them.
What has been the development of the legislation? Is there any legislation at all?
No. There was a few years ago, they established that transsexuals who had gone through treatment, who were castrated, they could be included in the anti-discrimination legislation under gender, but it's much more common with discrimination before you reach the castration stadium, and for people who don't seek any treatment, who don't want it or who can't have it, or they don't, at the moment they don't have any
protection.
Yeah.
What is the equivalent of the castration stadium when the case is female to male?
Removal of the ovaries, not just cutting the but actually removal. And that's the difference between castration and sterilization. Castration, you actually remove that and the reproductive organ. Yeah.
Are there reports of high levels of discrimination based on?
We don't have any reports. There's not been any service done. Not any. Nothing. And it's kind of frustrating. Yeah.
So it seems like the situation is a little bit precarious in terms of the scope of action, and why is that so? Why is that so in relationship to the fact that Norway has been so proactive in terms of gay and lesbian rights, and then later on also bisexual rights? Mm. Why is the transgendered issue a late boomer?
I tend to blame the Organization for Transsexuals, because they have been very strict on separating transsexuals from LGB or even transvestite or transgender people.
Under the grounds that?
The transsexualism has nothing to do with sex, according to them. And basically they're right, but I think we have to focus on reality and not words.
What is that reality?
We have possibility to be under the umbrella of LGBT, and we have an elevation quite well-organized organization with all over the country. So it's that possibility. It's also the coexistence of being gay and transsexuals, for example, because the members of our transgender network is mostly gay transsexuals who were allowed treatment in some years ago when it was not so strict as it is today, more liberal. Also, we have people who get rejected, partly because of their sexual orientation, and that makes it easier to be in the LDH and to be a part of the LGBT. It's also when people get discriminated, it also for lesbians and gay, it's mostly because of their gender expression, because a man is too feminine or a woman is too masculine, and that's the basis for the thought that we work on a not doing gender identity politics. We're working from this happens, this has to be done, we have to do something about this, what can we do, and not focus on the identity of the people who get discriminated, because in the transgender network we almost have an identity for each member. We have, so far we have 13 members. What I see out in society, and when I wrote, I published my first book of poetry last year and did some interviews with newspapers and so on, and my experience is that most people are not transphobic, they just don't know anything about it, and some are also very frightened to ask, because the Harry Benjamin Reason Center has focused so much on words. First they were transsexuals, then they became transgender. That is a translation of transgender, but it should still mean only transsexuals. It just ruled out the sexual part. So everyone got confused, and now they're just ordinary men and women with a little bit different stories. That's how they see themselves. So my impression is that most people get very confused, and that's why I'm not that I'm not so interested in what words we use, but how they work.
The views of the gender clinic that have informed the Benjamin organization are based on, I suppose, a kind of medical discourse, right?
Yeah.
And that medical discourse is which one? And also not only medical in terms of physical health, but in terms of mental health.
Yeah.
What is that background?
The gender clinic consists of one psychiatrist, several psychologists, and they are the main staff, the people who are fully employed by the clinic. And then you have surgeons and a social worker, kind of, who I think only work part-time. At least the surgeons only work. They work with other surgeries as well. And the psychiatrist is the leader of the gender clinic. So it's very... the discourse is psychiatry, and I found a lot of psychoanalytical influence, at least. It's very focused on your story, the coherent story from childhood to now, and it should be linear, and it should be consistent, and not broken postmodern pieces.
So in that sense, that story is seen as constitutive of your condition.
Yeah.
So it's not a biological discourse. It's a
well, they're trying to find something biological. One of our members told me that he was asked to participate in this research project where they should take a sample of blood from him and from his relatives. And before he got that request, he was talking about how he had a lesbian aunt and a maybe gay grandparent or something. So so it seems that the idea is that if you combine kind of lesbian and gay genes in a large enough amount, then you will have a transsexual. And I think that's kind of scary. also because even though they should find a biological ground for transsexualism, then you will, I think that's also always going to be variation outside of the boxes, kind of. And it's important that people get help, no matter how their genes or how their brain looks. Or
have you had an experience at the gender clinic or the Benjamin organization?
Yeah, both.
Would you mind sharing that experience with me? I mean, I don't know if that becomes too personal, because you might need to share your
Well, the gender clinic is the easiest, because I've read my journal there and so forth. I started there in fall 2006, and the first year I had one psychologist who was really nice and gay, I liked him. He recommended that I got a diagnosis and treatment, but you have to get cleared by both the psychologist and the psychiatrist. So, and he resigned his job just after writing that in my journal that he would recommend treatment. And then I got to the psychiatrist, and she said that she hadn't read my journal or anything, and she got really surprised that I had a kid. I have a daughter. She's now 5 years old. And she said I should recognize the birth as a rape of my own body. And I don't think that is healthy to think of it that way. I think it's not doing any good. So I wouldn't.
But your giving birth was a conscious decision to have a baby.
No.
It
was kind of an accident.
But it was a decision to have the baby.
Yeah. I don't think I wouldn't do it again. And I wouldn't recommend it for any trans men. It wasn't so I don't think it. I don't think it kind of ruined me like I think a rape would. And something good came out of it, because it made me realize that I actually had a body and I had to do something about it. I got my daughter, and she's wonderful. So, and I also recognize that working with an LGBT organization, a lot of lesbians and gay, the first question they, or reaction they get from parents, or often mother, is, well, then I don't get to have any grandchildren. So I kind of feel I've done my part.
If we may return to this need for you to recognize that as a violation or a rape of your own body, where does that come from in terms of that psychological discourse?
Because it's the only explanation for a trans man giving birth in their discourse. In their point of view, if you're transsexual, you have to hate your body. You don't use your sexual organs for anything. So, so it contradicts everything, or almost everything I believe in.
So once you decide not to recognize this as a rape, what happens? You cannot be treated.
I think it's contributed to the rejection, but there's also the question of me being gay, because his psychiatrist also told me that she would really recommend that I had sex with a woman. And I wouldn't do that either. So, because I didn't find women attractive. I think testosterone might have changed something there. I might be actually bisexual. I'm still, but mainly I'm attracted to men. So for me to, I tried to tell her that, actually kind of graphical, that I don't know any woman who would volunteer to have sex with a man who was shutting his eyes because he didn't want to think about it, the woman he's having sex with, but she didn't listen.
So once you don't fall under these categories, you are released. I mean, you don't fall under the possibilities of treatment.
And there's also they divide between early onset and late onset. Early onset, then you, well, kind of, I tend to say that it's when you put your head out, or your mother, you're screaming, "I'm a boy, I'm not a girl," even though you might think so, but I'm a boy. Mostly it's as soon as you learn to speak, or as soon as you see that there's a difference between the sexes, you should tell someone, or you should at least remember that you thought about it and very strongly wanted to be the other sex, because the gender clinic only believes in two sexes.
You're approaching the clinic was because you want to have this operation?
Yeah. I want the whole package, with the hormones, and I got hormones this month.
And they're not giving you the whole package means it's because you might, to their eyes, be uncertain. You might regret the decision.
Yeah. And I think that's an it's an okay view if I were 15. But I really think I'm old enough to know and to decide for myself.
Is that a final word, or can you appeal?
I tried to appeal, but it didn't work out. I got a rejection. They told me to I could come back in 5 to 10 years. But I can't see how that would change anything, because I won't have a new childhood, a worse one. and if I couldn't try to go back in 5 years and lie about all the things that I should have lied about in the first place. But I don't think that would work, and I'm not a good liar. So, we do have a right to second opinion in the law of patients' rights, but that excludes people with rare diagnosis, and transsexualism is a rare diagnosis.
Has this personal experience motivated your political work?
Yeah.
In what way?
First, I wanted to get to know other people with similar experiences, because well, one of the first things that I saw was that I'm not the only person here, and that kind of gave me I saw that as a possibility to do something, because if it had been just me, then I just had to deal with it somehow. But but seeing the pattern that that there are more people being rejected, that this in January there was a trans woman in Trondheim who she actually cut off her testicles at home in her bathroom. Because she, after she got rejected from the gender clinic, and you have, that's kind of an extreme story, or it's kind of very to the point, because she just removed the part that's making trouble for her. But there was also the suicides. One of the first things, or after the first meeting with a psychiatrist at the gender clinic, she told me, well, you're so resourceful and intelligent that you'll make it anyway, which I didn't like. But I think she might be right. and I saw that not everyone has a family who's supportive, and a lot of people don't have a lot of friends. A lot of transgender people isolate themselves because they're not being recognized by anyone. And I thought that I can do something about that because I had the resources.
You've sketched a kind of grim picture, in the sense that there is really no recognition unless you abide by the categorical.
Yeah, but I think most of the people in need of treatment, either they do feel that they don't feel that they're lying at the gender clinic or have to, or they're actually lying. So my guess is that most of the people in need of, roughly 60% of the people in need of care actually get it.
So you're a minority in that.
Yeah,
area.
I think so.
Can you try to analyze, I mean, from your experience and perspective, this categorical thinking, I mean, I can think of it in terms of legal problems, right? And positioning in terms of the medical establishment and so on and so forth. But I would be interested in hearing yours or your colleagues' thoughts about these categories in a more analytical way.
Well, first, it's very difficult to get transgender or transgender rights recognized as human rights or as a question of rights at all, because it's a medical issue. There seems to be a, if it's a medical issue, then it has nothing to do with human rights, which is
because human rights are social issues.
Yeah.
But the relationship between the medical and the social in this case seem to be completely intertwined.
Yeah, and history should have taught us that this is not, things aren't that simple. I guess they, I'm sure they had diagnosis for forced sterilization of ethnic minorities in this 50s, 60s, and 70s too, as an example.
But who is at the head of this decision? Is it a trans person that is in the leadership of the medical discourse and psychological discourse?
No, the head. The gender clinic don't know transsexuals. Harry Benjamin Resource Center, well, they're transsexuals, but most of them were in the middle of treatment when the service were shut down in the late 90s. Well, to me it seems like they've forgotten how it felt to be at that stage in the middle, or to be the object of categorization, you know, so violenting way, actually. A lot of people told me that the first reaction to the gender clinic, when they came there to fill out a form with a lot of really intimate questions, kind of who have you, who you, or answer them to a psychologist, who are you attracted to, how do you have sex, how do you feel about your genitals, how do you use them. And a lot of people get pissed off just by the questions. And there's also the issue of the way the questions get asked. Because it's not like they want to know or learn about diversity, for example. It's kind of, do you fit in this narrow table? That's all they want to know.
I'm not a trans person, but from my experience, it seems like it's the same logic of wanting to define the homosexual identity as a, you know, as a kind of straightforward one. That it's, in a way, that's why, for example, the bisexual person is always doubted, right?
Yeah, I see a lot of common issues, because the bisexuals are the problem of the bisexuals from a gay normative point of view is that they're not stable. Then they can't say, I was born this way, I just have to, and that's the that view or argument that we're born this way, is very strong. in Norway and a lot of other countries too, I think. And as soon as you say, I wasn't born this way, but I have to be this way, or I don't care what the reason is, but this is what I need, then it seems it's difficult for people to deal with it.
The LLH is a social organization, right? It has a social outreach.
Yeah.
But I imagine it might have some kind of political, I mean, it has had clearly in gay and lesbian issues political impact. But is your aim to, through the social projects that you're developing, also influence the legislative?
Yeah, in time. I think it's quite a long way to go, I think. But, well, I hope so.
And do you think of that as a in a way as constructing a new identity of leadership for the trans population?
Yeah, definitely. And there's also the social and also the creative work we're planning to do is a lot about empowering people to see that they have resources on their own, that they're we can help each other and
I mean, because it appears to me that it's an issue of leadership. If the leadership there is a hegemonic one, then you might be in need of a restructuring of that leadership.
Yeah.
Or do you envision yourself as a leader in that way?
Actually, I think I'm too much of an individualist. I'm not that comfortable with speaking for a lot of other people. I like to just speak for myself. I also think that I'm not sure about how it. I think there might be a conflict between being an author and being an activist at some point. And I also think it's important to have several voices to be heard. And maybe the leader should be more of a diplomat than I am.
See that there is a leadership around out there in the process of being formed?
Yeah.
Or a leader?
Yeah, I think I guess I, in some ways, have that position. Yeah, but I'm kind of. It's very strange because I don't have any respect for authorities. Actually, I despise them mostly. And to be seen as an authority myself is kind of weird.
Well, you can always fashion yourself as a plural and inclusive face of authority.
Yeah, but then you have to be a diplomat. I'm trying to be one, but I don't think I can do that forever. You can't have a. The importance is the community. That if you have a strong community, then there will be a leader of some sort.